You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
This is The Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen. Brian is so talented that he's booked three separate jobs this week, but we couldn't wait to talk to Vanessa Tyson for the third time. Vanessa, welcome
yes.
back.
Thank you so much.
And the nice thing about not having Brian here is mm-hmm. that we can finally talk about districting, which is what I've wanted to talk about since episode one.
Of course.
So why don't we were just talking about this before. Why don't we start with the history of districting, why districting matters, and Elbridge Gerry.
Okay. So the congressional redistricting process is you know, somewhat varied and complex, but it starts back in the 1700s, really, and continues into this day, where each 10 years a census is supposed to be taken. Now, you'll note in the South, this was not always the case. In fact, you know, in many circumstances, they did not take a census or do redistricting, go through the redistricting and reapportionment process, you know, from roughly 1910 to 1960. Just keep that in mind. We'll talk about that in a bit later. Mm-hmm. Now, with the redistricting process, the way that it works, a standard thing, you take the census every 10 years, right? So 2010, 2000, 1990, so on and so forth. From there, right, the census measures basically who is living where, right? You know, you have statewide numbers, you have countywide numbers, you have citywide numbers, and you gather information all the way to the neighborhood block level. Mm-hmm. Right. This is the central premise of it, is that we can measure how many people are here, roughly who they are. Are they men or women? Are they college graduates? Are they employed? I mean, there's so much rich data that can be collected. And I'm sure that a number of your listeners have actually, you know, received surveys in the mail. I've received surveys in the mail, and I always, you know, answer it and turn it in, and they'll come and bug you if you don't. Trust me, they'll start calling your house. Being like, Professor Tyson, you have not submitted your survey to the U.S.
Department
of
Commerce.
They should.
But they probably don't.
No, they probably don't.
Citizen, you have failed in your duties.
Exactly. I'm like, I'm sorry. It's in China. What are you going to do? You know, this is the guilt of, like, those who travel. But so what they do is they compile all of this data. They aggregate it, and they see state by state how the population demographics have changed. In so doing, with the population demographic changes, they then decide, they formulate which states should have more congressional districts, which states should have less, reflecting changes in population, right? Because you want congressional districts to be roughly equal to the extent that you can. No state can have less than one House representative, right? So, for instance, Idaho or Wyoming, right? States with small populations. The largest district, the largest number is the state of California, which has 53. Mm-hmm. And so you have a range.
53 congressional districts.
Yes, 53 right. congressional districts. From the very top of the state to down to San Diego.
But so even to talk about something like Idaho, right? Mm-hmm. So on average, right, the sort of the simplest math would be mm-hmm. take the population of the United States, divide it by 435, and that's the number of people that should be electing each congressperson, right?
Roughly.
Yeah, but in places like Idaho, actually, if you want to influence Congress, move to Idaho. Right?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, this becomes a fundamental thing, right? That when we look at actual change, like imbalance in terms of population, right? When the U.S. was founded, the rough population difference between, I think it was Virginia and Delaware, were roughly 12 to 1 in terms of the size of the population. Now, mind you, that includes slave states, and that's just a whole other can of worms.
Right.
But... Right. The current population difference between the largest state and the smallest state is roughly 70 to 1, with the smallest state population at this time being Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And so what you see is, though, even though, you know, California has more than slightly over 70 times the population of the smallest state, it only due to various demographics and what have you, every state is guaranteed, you know, a congressional representative, the number in terms of representatives is 53 to 1, mm-hmm. right? Now, here's the deal. So you go through the census, right? You decide, you figure out who's in what state. Then you go through reapportionment, right? And that only happens at the congressional level related to the House,
mm-hmm.
right? It doesn't happen in the Senate because Senate seats are allocated according to per state, which is written into the Constitution. But
do you think that's the thing, right? So there's however many people there are in Wyoming,
yeah.
right? Which
yeah.
is, I think, less than 500,000 or something
yeah.
like that. And they get to elect two senators,
mm-hmm.
and we in California have millions of people, and we get to elect two senators. I mean, there's obviously historical reasons why that was done, right? The Connecticut Compromise. But do you think that today that makes sense, or?
Well, I think it's highly problematic, and I'll tell you why. You have so many, for instance, let's think about this in terms of revenue, and I love talking about taxes. So we'll talk about revenue for just a second, right?
California. So did Ronald Reagan.
Well, you know, we approach it slightly differently, but okay. Though he did raise taxes quite a number of times.
You remind me of the Gipper. You're a great communicator.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm honored.
Yeah. You should be. No, he is. He really was a great communicator.
He was. I hope that I don't stoke fires of sadness or fear or negativity quite the way that he did. Though he had many successes as well. Here's the deal, right? There are certain ramifications to having kind of a disproportionate benefit going to small states, right? One of which is that, you know, Californians pay a tremendous amount of taxes, right? We, you know, technically, I think we're in the top 10 in terms of like the largest economies in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the U.S. is in the top 3, but California is, you know, producing quite a bit, right? We pay so much in federal income taxes that the state does not get back, right? It gets, when we think about redistribution of wealth,
mm-hmm.
right? You need to think about this even on a state-by-state basis, that the amount that Californians put into the federal system, right, then gets redistributed to very small states,
mm-hmm.
right? So small states wield a disproportionate amount of power in terms of, you know, redistribution of wealth, redistribution of resources in the United States. Similarly, right, what we've found is that small states – on average, and this doesn't include Delaware tends to be more blue and what have you, but the smaller states tend to be, you know, more Republican, generally more conservative. They tend to lack sizable numbers of minority populations. So these states aren't necessarily, they wield, you know, disproportionately high amounts of power, but they also don't quite reflect the needs of a larger American population, right? So you're seeing kind of a redistribution of wealth to small states, as well as a much more conservative approach to politics, right? Which is, it becomes very interesting. The other thing is we found that this, actually that the small states on average tend to be much more in favor of coal and other and less environmentally friendly. And that, you know, produces any number of problems as well.
Right. And I mean, you know, they're just that's partly their experience of life. Right. They're rural inherently. And so they don't necessarily understand the problems of an urban environment with the same intimacy that people who live in cities do.
Mm-hmm.
And then often these places actually mine coal or are mining places. Right. And
mm-hmm.
so obviously they're going to have a pro-mining stance because they're looking at it for jobs. And then on the third level, I mean, you know, in L.A., we experience pollution very directly.
Certainly.
You know, in Big Sky, you can drive as many cars as you want, and it's not, you're not going to feel that pollution.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you can drive your gas guzzler 800 miles, and you're still breathing relatively clean air. It's the concentrated areas of people where these issues become a greater problem. And
mm-hmm.
at the same time, right, our money is being redistributed to small states, whereas we may need that money to actually deal with any number of environmental issues. When we get back, last week we were talking about infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is something that, you know, case in point, right?
Mm-hmm.
That transportation money, right, that could allow for mass transit and could provide for, you know, clean energy and so on and so forth, is oftentimes redistributed to coal states.
Mm-hmm.
There's an irony there, or
mm-hmm.
at least there is to me. I don't know.
Well, there's also, I mean, even the Bridge to Nowhere, right?
Yeah.
Ted Stevens' famous project, right? So that was, the circumstances were that there was already a ferry to this island.
Yes.
The ferry was faster than the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the bridge cost how many billions of dollars?
I don't remember off the top of my head, but plenty.
And then not only that, there were like six people on the island or something atrocious, right?
Give or take.
Yeah.
Well, and that's part of the appropriations process as well, right? Stephen mm-hmm. sat on the appropriations committee, which meant that, you know, he could when people talk about pork, right, you know, bringing home the bacon in politics, you know, what they're really talking about is you know, I guess, what is it referred to? The loopholes, the
earmarks.
Earmarks, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, what does this mean? Now, and people get confused when they talk about it, so I want to bring this up. The Appropriations Committee, you know, will set an amount of a given budget for, you know, for a certain department, right? Mm-hmm. They'll have 13 bills on average every year. If they don't pass them, then you have an impasse and you have what we saw in October, last October, as a government shutdown. So the Appropriations Committee will approve a certain budget, a certain amount of time, a certain budget. From there, what we see is that certain people on the Appropriations Committee of that budget, you know, so money that has already been approved, right, can then identify a pet project that they want to earmark for. They will earmark a bit of money from the budget that will then be specifically for a pet project, you know, many cases in their home district or in their home state. One case that was very interesting was, you know, a Republican congressman from Texas decided that he needed an airport. Mm-hmm. In his district. Now, this airport not only provided tons of jobs in terms of construction, then from there, it also led to tons of jobs in terms of having a functioning airport. Mm-hmm. The problem, however, was that nobody was flying in and out of this airport. This was a small detail, mm-hmm. a glitch in the process. And as such, you know, the airport eventually closed.
Now.
Yes.
Just to stop you there.
Of course.
Isn't that a great example of letting the market decide? Isn't this part of the problem of having government start allocating money towards things is that it's not being decided on a supply-demand basis, right?
Sure.
The government can write something into existence, say, there will be an airport here and it's built regardless of the demand. It's not to say that there's not a place for both, but I think that's the thing is I think part of what's broken down in this country is that, you know, it's not that the Republicans are totally crazy, right, or that the Democrats are totally crazy. It's that they keep on focusing on the same 50% of the truth.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. I mean, I'm willing to grant you that, and generally we agree.
Mm-hmm.
What I think I would say is that not always that I don't always trust the market as well, right? Like, I mean, and so, you know, yes, government makes any number of horrible decisions, right, on a, you know, regular basis, and they don't seem to learn from their mistakes. Mm-hmm. But that said,
Well, they don't learn from their mistakes because we don't hold them accountable.
Granted.
Like, they don't have to learn from their mistakes. I mean, if the system, if your reelection doesn't depend on you doing a good job, and if your reelection instead depends on you bringing home the bacon and you doing whatever, mm-hmm. then, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I think our government, based on the incentives that they're responding to, is doing amazingly.
Well, they really are. It works exactly the way it's supposed to.
Well, it works exactly the way that it's incentivized to.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. But that, I think, has to do much more with kind of structural rules that have been put in place for a long time. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that, you know, like, incumbents benefit tremendously from simple incumbency status.
Right, right? And incumbency just means you're okay. The guy who
is already holding the office, right. Or the woman.
Right. I'm using guy in a generic sense, in the same way that I believe that when, you know, Jefferson said all men are created equal, that he did mean it in a generic sense when he wrote it, because the Jefferson who wrote the Declaration of Independence is not the same Jefferson who wrote Notes on a Virginia Planter or whatever it's called.
Sure, sure. But, you know, then again, you sit there and you think about Sally Hemings and everything just goes to bunk.
Didn't the original drafts of the Declaration of Independence have like a sterling condemnation of slavery?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they got axed. They were like, that's not going to fly.
And you want to know what that was, kids? Special interest.
Yeah, it was. Southerners.
No, I know.
Yeah.
No.
But I mean, you know, so that's the thing, right? So special interests have always been there, but the degree is how much influence are they allowed to have? And
exactly.
Are the people there as a check on them or not?
But also, you know, I mean, when we think about incumbency, we have to think about the kind of privileges that incumbents have.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, they have, Frankie, not only do they have a staff that exists in Washington, D.C., you know, they have a staff in, you know, in their home district. In fact, they may have multiple offices and multiple staffs in their home district, depending
and on multiple homes
and multiple homes. Well, that's common, right? Just to be just to be fair.
But that's I mean, that's also a much more modern phenomenon. I mean, if you go back to the 50s, I mean, I think most of our representatives pretty much lived in D.C. Mm-hmm. for most of their term and rarely came back to their home district, whereas now.
Yeah,
they come back all the time.
You know, and again, and maybe that is a benefit of accountability is the idea that they do that they are much closer to their districts than they used to be in certain respects, they're much more present.
But at the same time, the downside of that is that, you know, it means their work week is down to what, 3.5 days?
Well, their legislative week is 3.5 days. And then, you know, they go home. And I mean, the typical day of a legislator, for those of you who might want to run for office sometime, is, you know, and I encourage you to do so. And yet, please understand what your day will look like. You will wake up around 5. You will start reading the paper, listening to NPR on the radio while you're getting dressed and going to work, taking your shower and stuff like that. In fact, you may have to blast it really loud. Right. And that place, you will be waking up your significant other who would prefer to sleep in.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying. From there, what happens is you will drive into work wherever you go, you know, into the office, into the Capitol. You'll have your own parking space, which is lucky because you're running late on time. You've been stuck in traffic somewhere near Washington, D.C. If any of you have been there, you know the Beltway is nothing short of a disaster. Talk about traffic infrastructure later. From there, right, you usually have a breakfast fundraiser. Right, which means that you're at some place, you know, some restaurant called Tortilla Coast, which is just off Capitol Hill, where you're kissing butt to a whole bunch of rich people. Have fun with that. You know, tell me how it went. You know, you're trying to make as much money as possible. From there, you know, by 10:30, you're back in the office. You're reading, you know, not only are you still trying to keep up with the news, but you're reading all the events of the day that are coming up. So you're figuring out what your schedule is, how many hearings you have to go to, how many meetings you have with various constituents. But really, you're going to be meeting with lots of special interests, too. And they're going to be banging down your door because they want you to vote this way. They want you to vote that way. Or they've already written a bill that they want you to carry yourself. Now,
let's emphasize that point.
Oh, yes. Okay. Most of the legislation that is coming through Congress is not organic, shall we say. Instead, it is often already pre-written by special interests, whether it be big pharmacology, whether we're talking about big oil, big ag, right? There are many
unions. Let's
But I mean, in terms of the ones that I've been most worried about, in terms of the legislation, and I tend to follow lots of legislation, you know, big ag is kind of like my biggest worry right now, quite frankly, in part because, you know, when you think about pesticides, when you think about the kind of cognitive dysfunctioning that these pesticides cause, you know, to wide swaths of American people, this is, you know, becomes very problematic to me. So you're going through the day. You're going to go to hearings, right? You may have to step in and step out if you have to have a meeting. Normally, if you're on the Democratic or Republican side, they actually have small little meeting rooms off off of a hearing room where you can meet with someone if you have to right away. You're going to have hearings all day. You're going to be going over legislation. Maybe it's a markup where you're going to go over legislation with red ink, you know, fixing up a piece of legislation that you don't like, making certain changes. Most amendments to all pieces of legislation happening in the committee process. Also, most legislation, over 90% of legislation, dies in committee, which means that if it does not make it out of committee, right, it will not see the light of day, you know, and will never go to a floor vote. From there, right, you know, so now we're looking at like maybe 3:30 or something like that. You're back in your office. You have if you're a member of Congress, you have your own private bathroom. I always thought that was kind of nice, you know, which is interesting because you don't have to worry if you're like, you know, like tapping your foot that perhaps you're like, making inroads with somebody else across the aisle. From there, you're going to be talking, you know, you're going to still be in meetings, lots of special interests. Who knows? Maybe you may have a constituent or two. Maybe you'll talk to a couple high school groups. And you're awake. Okay, mind you that you're still awake. Now, some Congress members are known for, this is a little secret, they're known for taking naps. They take naps in their office. But who wouldn't? It's a long effing day. The caffeine is worn off. What are you going to do? Now, votes usually happen in the evening. And they always happen in the PM in general, like so in the afternoon or evening. And the votes, you know, you'll usually have a sequence of votes. It may be 10 or 12. But basically, everybody goes there you know, they convene upon the, you know, the House floor or the Senate floor for that matter, and they proceed to cast their votes. And those are known as roll call votes. They take roll call. In the House, you can't simply leave it to the ayes and the nays for what it's worth. You need, everybody has their votes on record. But so that's how your day goes. And then after that, you go to yet another fundraiser, maybe two or three, right? Maybe it's your friend, you know, might not be your fundraiser. It may be your friend's fundraiser, right? Maybe you're going to somebody else's fundraiser so you can poach donors.
Mm-hmm.
Congress members do that too. They take naps, they poach donors. That's right. And in fact, you may go to your enemy's, you know, fundraiser and try to poach donors from your enemy. That's been known to happen on both sides of the aisle. It's remarkably amusing. And it's kind of fun to watch. But so your day, and then you may have more votes, right? You never know. You know, votes, depending upon the time of the year, depending upon what's going on, depending upon when, you know, how quickly Congress will be going into recess,
mm-hmm.
You may have votes as late as 3 a.m. in the morning. Right. In which case, by the way, you will be coming home, you know, and then waking up your significant other who, by the way, you already woke up in the morning, you know, the morning prior. So that's just terrible. Don't try to be quiet. Don't wake up your significant other. I speak from experience. Let people sleep. So your day is a very long day full of meetings, full of votes, full of fundraisers. You are constantly trying to raise money. You may also walk down the street a bit during your day and go, because you're not allowed to fundraise money in your office, right? This is one thing that you are not allowed to do. If you are on federal property, mm-hmm. right? But specifically if you're on if you're in your federal office, you are not allowed to raise money from your office, which means, right, that if you want to raise money, you need to go across the street to the DCCC, right, which is the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Candidate Committee, right, mm-hmm. campaign committee. And you, from there, you can make fundraising calls, right? Mm-hmm. But you are not allowed to make fundraising calls from your office. Even if it's a personal phone, even if you have a personal cell phone that you pay for yourself, you're not allowed to raise money from your office, right? You're mm-hmm. not allowed to use that office space. So you will be running around, but your main emphasis is going to be raising money, right? From, of course, special interests. And the more money those interests have, the more money they can give you, which means the more time they will likely get.
Mm-hmm.
And you will also be doing lots of voting and hopefully committee hearings, and hopefully you will be paying attention in those.
So doesn't that set up an inherent, like, aren't we saying two things at the same time as a country? If we're saying that you cannot raise money on federal property,
sure.
because that is a conflict of interest.
Of course.
But then at the same time, we're saying you can raise as much money as possible because that's not a conflict of interest.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think that the Buckley versus Vallejo case back in the 70s was rather astute thinking, though I probably would have banned money altogether, right?
Mm-hmm.
just being me. And here's the deal.
Well, but I think that's actually an interesting idea. I mean, it's certainly an idea that I've had. Like, mm-hmm. in an environment where, you know, you have the internet and you have
sure.
all of these sorts of things, right?
Sure.
And obviously not everybody has equal internet access. Right. But even so, like, why do we even need money in politics?
Your guess is as good as mine.
I mean,
really what you're doing is you're funding an industrial complex that is highly problematic and
mm-hmm.
anti-democratic.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, interesting thing is, on the one hand, you want everybody to be able to get their voice out and their voice heard, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I think that a number of people are dissuaded from running for office precisely because, oh, I don't know if I can raise enough money.
Right.
You know,
but I think that's the interesting thing is that, you know, people like Larry Lessig, like their mm-hmm. proposals inevitably involve some sort of public funding or whatever
sure.
it is. But even so, like, that's the thing. Why even require that?
Well, now, I mean, I think there's something to be said for trying to get the message out to various media. And
mm-hmm.
what I mean by this is that, you know, like, I'm very lucky that you allow me to be on the podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Brian Callen Show. You should all listen to it.
It's right. highly esteemed.
With Hunter Motz, right? Now, I'm very lucky that you've invited me on your show to make my message for free,
mm-hmm.
right? Holy moly, that's awesome. Now, on the other hand, most people that may not necessarily have the opportunity, right?
So, yeah, but I think that's the irony is mm-hmm. that, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Mike and Rena have set up this studio and all that mm-hmm. sort of stuff, and that allows it to be a high quality production.
Sure.
But what are the real barriers to anybody getting their message out there today?
I think, though, that when you, I mean, when you think about advertising, mm-hmm. right, advertising in this country now, on the one, it works.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, and we know because everybody decides that they, you know, like, you know, kids watch Fruit Loops commercials and all of a sudden they're insanely interested in Fruit Loops, which will eventually kill them. Right. Small details.
Yeah.
You know, and which have no fruit and they're nominally a loop. Now, on the other hand, though, like, but we know these ads work.
Right.
Right. And
100%.
You want to reach a mass media. And you want to
yeah, but it's also I think that's the thing, right? Is mm-hmm. that you know what you've just pointed at with Fruit Loops?
Yeah.
Is the fact that what an ad does is it convinces you that what you are being sold is different from the reality of what you are getting,
mm-hmm.
and so by nature
of, and it's pretty colors
and it's pretty colors, right? But by nature of a 30-second ad, mm-hmm. it is impossible to communicate. I think anything that vaguely deals with like a policy or an idea or any sort of platform or mm-hmm. anything like that. So I think that even like there's the problem of money in politics, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of time that politicians spend, you know, you talked about the fundraisers in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you talked about the fundraisers
Certainly.
At night, and then there's also the fact that, you know, that then makes them fatigued, which then if they're fatigued, how good are the quality of their decisions? How much attention do they have for really reading through complex documents or doing anything like that?
Certainly.
Right? And then on top of that, there's the amount of time they spend dialing for dollars, right? So you're not creating a good cognitive space for our leaders to make good decisions.
No, I mean, it's actually right. counterproductive. Yes.
Right. But on top of that, then there's also the problem of, you know, what does a 30-second ad space do to speech?
Well, I think the difficulty is, you know, and I want to think about it like this. I'm a big fan of kind of door-to-door campaigning. I'm a mm-hmm. big fan of, like, shaking hands and, like, actually trying to meet people.
Right.
Right. Like, you know. I like people. It's fun to meet people.
Right.
And not every candidate does, but that's, you know, a story for another day. Suffice it to say, right, that when you want an actual ground team, which is something that I'm a big fan of, if
mm-hmm.
Even flyers, mm-hmm. right, and this is also important, particularly for challengers, right? As mm-hmm. I mentioned before, incumbents have any number of privileges. One of them is called a franking privilege.
Mm-hmm.
A franking privilege is that they have approximately about, you know, they $100,000 a year in which they can send out mailings to all of their constituents, right? And it may be a targeted mailing depending upon age or this or that, but they can send out, they have the ability to kind of send out their own publicity,
mm-hmm.
right? This is a huge privilege because they can then take credit, you know, whether or not this is completely true, they can take credit for projects in the district. They can take credit for having, you know, a town hall meeting here. They can take credit for legislation that's gone through that they have co-authored or so on and so forth, right? And so what I think about is kind of like, how do you necessarily create, if you are a challenger, if you want accountability,
mm-hmm.
right? How, you know, how you will need money to kind of, you know, to go to challenge, right, the
mm-hmm.
the benefits that this incumbent already has.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't just be door to door, though, you know, you can leave a sticker here, you can leave a flyer there, but you need a chance to get the word out.
Yeah,
right?
But can't you also, like, okay, so there's franking privileges, right?
Yeah.
And franking privileges is just you get to send as much free mail as you want, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the federal government controls the U.S. Postal Service, and so for
yeah.
it would make no sense for federal officials to pay a federal institution for a federal service, right?
Sure.
So, but in the same way that we say on federal property, you can't raise money, why don't we just say you can have as much franking privileges as you want, but you cannot use it for fundraising purposes?
Oh, well, no. Franking isn't allowed for fundraising purposes. In
mm-hmm.
fact, that would be illegal. And if,
right.
If you're a member of Congress, note to self, don't do that. Don't do that. There are a lot of things.
Yeah.
I can tell you rules to the kingdom come. However, right, franking is still allowed as a self-promotion purpose,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's basically free publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be, you know, it certainly cannot be, right? It
mm-hmm.
cannot be fundraising, right? But it's basically, it increases your name recognition,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, as an incumbent, you already have, but it's free publicity, right?
Mm-hmm.
About like, you know, I can send out a letter.
Mm-hmm.
Right, to everyone in Los Angeles, basically, right, or at least in my district, right,
mm-hmm.
roughly 750,000 people, in which I can tell them I am fabulous, and did I mention how fabulous I am? right? And that essentially, you know, I mean, that's the beauty of franking, right?
Right.
I can tell you 80 reasons why I'm fabulous. They don't have to be true, but 80 reasons why I'm fabulous. And then you'll remember my name. And you know, come November, you'll sit there and be like, oh, Vanessa Tyson, she's so fabulous, right? Why? Because I primed you to think I was fabulous.
Yeah, but the thing is, firstly, do people even read those letters?
Sure. I mean, yeah. Like, the bottom line is you're planting the seed, right? And that's the thing. It's like people say, oh, I wasn't really, really watching the commercials, right? And I hate commercials, by the way. But, you know, they say they weren't really watching the commercials. But that's the thing. It's all subliminal. Right?
Yeah, well, it's a simple fact that you recognize the name. And then you go into the voting booth and it's like, oh, a guy I've heard of or some nobody, right?
Right. Well, recognition is, I mean, one of the key things that we need to understand, even in terms of like cognitive psychology, right? That the more we recognize something, the more familiar it becomes and the more we like it, whether or not we should, right? Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, you can listen to the worst song on the radio, like the absolute worst song ever written, right? And I could name a couple artists that probably wrote it, right? Or at least, you know, I can name the ones who brought it to your attention. Now, here's the deal. Right. The more you listen to it, even if you listen to the song, you're like, I hate this song. The song sucks. Right. You know, five or six times later, all of a sudden you're jamming in your car.
Right.
Right. Like you can't get it out of your head. Oh, my God. And then you have to buy it on iTunes and then you have to listen to it on repeat till you can finally get it out of your system. Now, that's the same thing with incumbency. Right.
Yeah. But I mean, like, again, to break this down.
Sure.
Right. So there's no doubt name recognition, familiarity, all of these sorts of things work.
Yeah.
But whether I'm voting for a candidate, I mean, like whether I'm voting for the incumbent or the challenger based on the fact of name recognition, well, that's not a good thing for a democracy. Like that's not how you want to be selecting people. So
that's still human nature to a certain extent.
I understand, right? It absolutely is. But I think that's the thing is that, you know, if you get like people, you know, how much do people read those letters? Like, I don't know if like Henry Waxman ever sent me one of those letters. If he did, I probably threw it away.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
But, even if people do read those letters, right, which I don't think most of them do.
Okay. Maybe it's just me.
Yeah. I think you're an outlier in that sense. Because I think, you know, we're also, you know, I mean, politicians, like throughout history, people have always been skeptical of politicians because they know that politicians will, to a certain extent, lie to them and tell them what they want to hear and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I think that that's the thing. Part of what we have to recognize is that, yes, cognitive psychology, and we now live in an age of highly powerful, hot media. And, you know, the question is whether we even want to do anything that encourages those hot media to be a part of our decision making. Like, should TV advertising even be a part of how we're electing candidates or not?
Should it be? I don't know. I mean, I think it's a catch-22. Like, I mean, personally, I have a problem with advertising in general. I try to avoid it as much as possible, but we're inundated, right? We're every day when you're just, I mean, driving down the street, you have billboards, you have all sorts of, you know, I mean, you're inundated with all sorts of...
Yeah, but when was the last time you bought a box of Fruit Loops?
My mom didn't let me eat cereal.
Yeah, but when was the last time you bought a box of Fruit Loops?
Never.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the point is, it's not that we're powerless in the face of advertising.
Well, no. Oh, okay. Yeah. Here, let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Okay. I have these dreams. I always have dreams. I have very vivid dreams. But I have dreams where I am like a chain smoker, right?
Uh-huh.
Chain smoker, right?
Right.
Like I can't get enough, you know, cigarettes. Like I'm just puffing.
Right.
Now, mind you, I never learned how to smoke, right? I have never smoked a cigarette. I've never smoked anything, right?
Philip Morris offers a small instructional manual, a step-by-step guide to becoming a chain smoker.
Exactly, right? Like I'm positive, right? But like, you know, but I have these dreams where I'm like a chain smoker. Now, what's interesting, right, is that, you know, I'll forget this dream. I'll forget it until I'm in the supermarket and I see cigarettes and all of a sudden I'm fiending. I'm like, oh my God, I want one.
Really?
Yes. I'm like, oh my God, I need cigarettes. Oh my God, I need them. Like, I'm like literally like clawing. And then I'm like, I don't smoke. But this is about like the subconscious and what operates in our subconscious in general.
Yeah, but that's the point. How much cigarette advertising do you see? There's not that much cigarette advertising anymore.
But there was when I was a kid.
No, I understand.
I understand. The seed gets planted and it stays there.
No, I understand. But I think that's the thing. Yeah, sure, the seed has planted. But, you know, I mean, I think that the... there's a disease, right? Mm-hmm. There's a disease in our democracy. And the question is, do you solve the disease mm-hmm. by, like, trying to treat all of the symptoms? Do you mm-hmm. solve the disease by, like, giving, you know, money to other people so they can have stupid 30-second campaign ads with Swift Boat Veterans for Truth?
Yeah.
And, you know, and then Swift Boat Veterans Against Truth or Swift Boat Veterans for the Real, Real Truth?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
at a certain point, yes. And no, right? Because on the one hand, like, you know, this becomes a free speech issue, mm-hmm. right? It really does. Like, in terms of, you know, who is allowed to buy advertising time, right? And whether or not I agree with, you know, advertising time, right? There's still a reality that, you know, like, as of right now, the Supreme Court would, I mean, pretty much anything related to money is free speech, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that. But then there's also an issue of kind of, like, how we see the American public as the discerning entity, right? So on the one hand, like, should you have TV ads? Normative question. I don't know, right? But we, you know, should we have public financing? Yes, right? I wholeheartedly believe and support public financing, and particularly when it comes to, but also in terms of, like, ad space and ad time. I think the difficulty for me is that we actually did a considerable amount of regulation with McCain-Feingold, which, you know, was legislation that passed in 2002, also known as the Bipartisan Campaign Finance Reform Act, right? So, you know, Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, right? BICRA. So what you have in that was kind of a limit on soft money, right? Which was all sorts of money that parties could raise that could then just be used in, like, you know, whatever way possible, you know, in terms of advertising and manipulation of voters, right? And that was reined in, right? Now, it wasn't ended, you know, entirely, but it was considerably reined in by the McCain-Feingold legislation, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002. Here's the deal, right? That anytime, you know, I mean, that insofar as the Supreme Court back in the 1970s upheld campaign donations as free speech, and then, you know, not only reinforced it, but opened the floodgates of money with Citizens United and Speech Now case, even more recently with McCutcheon. These are three Supreme Court cases. You can look them up. Citizens United, just Google that. Speech Now, all one word, Google that. And then McCutcheon, McCutcheon.
Yeah, and in general, Wikipedia always has pretty good summaries of the cases.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know too much about Wikipedia. And students, if any students are listening, don't use Wikipedia because professors don't like that.
Yeah, they don't like it, but, you know, it's more accurate than the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Okay, yes, I agree with that, but what you could do is go to OYEZ. I think it's OYEZ.org, O-Y-E-Z. .org. They have, you know, kind of a database on Supreme Court cases. Suffice it to say, right? When you think about TV ads, right, and if this is still, you know, technically the money is still protected speech. So right now, for instance, in a utopian society, yes, we would get rid of money in campaigns. But you think about the people who are working, right? Campaigns take, you know, manpower and woman power, mm-hmm. right? And what does that mean, right? That you're going to need people going door to door. You're going to need people to, I don't know, set up an internet network. And the thing is that people can't...
Just to ask fundamental, like, questions, why do you need people going door to door who are paid? Like,
well,
I mean,
now, think about that. Think about it for a second, right? Like, this is an issue that we see in politics all the time, which is mm-hmm. an issue of unpaid labor. Right. Mm-hmm. So what happens? Right. I mean, even when you think about summer internships, right. You
know, but even let's think about, like, I'm just, you know, the voters are disengaged. Right. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that voter apathy is pretty high in the United States. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The question is why? And I mean, if we're going to talk about cognitive psychology, right, a large part of it is that we're inundated with bullshit, meaningless messages. Totally. Like, some guy comes to your door, he knocks on your door, and he's like, it's like, nobody likes Jehovah's Witnesses. Like, nobody likes, you know.
This is true.
I mean, the you know, I don't know what the conversion rate is there, right? But the point is that you have these people who are coming to you, and they're coming to you from a place of they're in a funny way, they're not really engaging with your humanity, right? You're just a statistic for them, and they want you to like agree to vote for whoever, whoever, whoever.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I wonder, like, if you look at in campaigning has changed long before campaign finance. It's changed a tremendous amount. They used to believe that it was ungentlemanly for a presidential candidate to campaign for himself.
Yeah.
Right?
Certainly. You know? Well, I mean, there are all sorts of gentlemanly rules and seem to be less gentlemanly, but whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, I mean, I think that's the thing. I wonder, like, there are these sort of things that we now take for granted that, oh, in a democracy, it is healthy to, like, have a guy come door to door and, like, say a bunch of bullshit to you that is not really true and, like, mm-hmm. to misrepresent the facts and not to be having an honest, sincere conversation about what is really best for the country, what really is going to serve for your needs and all of that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that in the environment of voter apathy,
yeah.
it makes sense. Well, we have to do something to engage the voter.
Yes.
But perhaps a lot of the stuff that we've been doing is, you know, leading to that voter apathy.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that we've been doing, I don't know if it's been leading to the voter apathy, but I certainly think that our policies have, right? Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that, you know, like we were talking before the show, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I was talking with Mike in particular about this reality, which was the upward and downward counterfactuals. You know, mm-hmm. Obama runs in 2008 and, you know, he's running largely based upon an upward counterfactual, right? The idea of hope, right? Like, well, if I... And here's the critical thing with a counterfactual. It usually includes if, right? Mm-hmm. If I were president, things would be awesome, mm-hmm. right? It would be fabulous because I'm fabulous, fabulous, fabulous. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were president, right, you know. And so it's basically kind of like the counterfactual is upward, right? Upward trajectory. Everything's going to be great if I become president. Now, the downward counterfactual starts using, you know, that's Obama the candidate. Right. Now, fast forward, you know, to January 20th, 2009, all of a sudden you're operating with kind of a much more downward counterfactual, right? Which is instead of manipulating the expectations upward, it now seems that the expectations are being manipulated downward. So what do I mean by that? You know, well, if the Republicans had won, it would have been worse, right? You know, Bush hadn't got us into this war, it would have been worse. If mm-hmm. you know, all of these ifs, these downward counterfactuals of like, well, it would have been worse if.
And
right.
Al Gore will be writing a counterfactual for the rest of his life.
Of course yeah. he will, right? I mean, that's his job. you know, he's like vice president forever.
Yeah.
But so the issue becomes, right, that if you have this down, you know, upward and downward counterfactuals, the fact is that, you know, what a candidate says is not necessarily what a candidate does,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's kind of a critical importance, right? Because even when we think about, you know, okay, if you didn't have financing, but you simply had a series of debates,
mm-hmm.
right? What you would still have...
Plus the environment of the internet, which allows you to get any position piece that you want out there.
Granted.
And you're not forcing people to pay attention or hijacking their attention. You're trying to appeal and seduce their attention.
Well, I mean, if you really want an engaged public, if you want somebody who's going... If you want everybody to participate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I would argue that I... Right. Now,
yeah.
not everybody does. Right. I mean, let's be frank. You know, when mm-hmm. you look at like voter ID laws, when you look at, you know, different structures that are, you know, legislation that's put into place, it's done so with a specific desire to depress voter turnout.
Mm-hmm.
That's problematic. You know, like if I win an election, I would like the idea that I won the election and everybody, you know, who wanted to participate could participate. One thing that I would do, for instance.
Saddam Hussein had that.
I heard.
He had 100% voter turnout, you know,
yeah.
99%
yeah.
voted
yeah.
for him.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know,
that's
he had a real mandate.
It's been happening in Iran, too. it's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Mugabe. Really. I mean,
details.
There's a guy who the people love.
Yeah. 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 Him and Hugo Chavez and
yeah.
like a whole slew of individuals. Right. No, I would not want to win by a landslide. Don't
yeah.
get me wrong, but I would want to win. You know, I think dissent is important, right? We've talked about this. But I would want to win with the idea that the turnout had been the highest ever,
mm-hmm.
right? That everybody came out. Now, there are ways that you could do this. Why is Election Day one day? That's ridiculous, right? I mean, especially for poor people. Poor mm-hmm. people who work, right? Poor people who do this, they do that, right? Like, the fact is that it shouldn't be one day. You should have at least a week.
Mm-hmm.
Right? No, I'm dead yeah. serious, right? Like, I really want at least a week.
Now, when would you begin counting, though? Would you wait until the week was over to count?
You know, I probably would. I mean, now that yeah. I think, only because you don't want it to turn into a horse race and you don't want it to turn into, you know, kind of a disaster, right?
But well, yeah, that's because I think that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, that was my next question.
I mean, you could have polling. Yeah. I mean, you certainly could have pollsters hanging out around the, you know, mm-hmm. around the voting booths and what have you, just like taking polls, mm-hmm. you know, 100 yards away. Right. But, mm-hmm. you know, polling to see who's voting what, when and where. Right. So you could have some idea. But yeah, I would probably stop counting. I wouldn't start like official counts
until the end of the
yeah,
week.
Until the end of the week. The other thing is that you see in a number of states that people have absentee voting across the board. Right. That mm-hmm. basically that, you know, your ballot is mailed to your home.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that it is subsequently, returned into mm-hmm. to your, you know, like mailed in. Right. You see that in the states of Washington as well mm-hmm. as Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it seems to be very good with the exception of homeless people. Right. Mm. Because if you still want the homeless people to be able to vote, you need to make sure that you actually do have polling locations that will be accessible and available, or at least that they can get access to a provisional ballot. For instance,
right.
you could get a provisional ballot at the U.S. Postal Service,
but
something
there's
of that
also,
nature, or
I mean,
DMV.
If you got, like, I mean, just thinking about this logistically,
sure.
right? With
sure,
homeless
sure.
people, presumably they don't have ID.
Yeah.
Right? And mm-hmm. so that's part of the question is then how do you track homeless people's votes, like to make sure that they're not voting multiple times?
You know, this is the issue. This is one issue that you have with kind of this identified voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which is, it doesn't really happen
Minnie
very
Mouse
often.
Minnie Mouse voted 1,000 times in
okay.
Chicago.
Okay,
yeah,
look, my mentor, Michael Dawson, his uncle was Congressman William Dawson, who, you know, ran the largest, you know, black political machine in U.S. history, mm-hmm. second to Booker T. Washington, right?
Mm-hmm.
This was the south side of Chicago, and he becomes Dawson becomes congressman. He was largely bedfellows, if you will, with the original Mayor Daley, right? So many, many dead people voted on the south side of Chicago. Many, many black people who had been dead, in some cases for decades,
yeah.
voted on the south side of Chicago.
Booker T. Washington voted.
Yeah, exactly. And again, and again,
and again.
And again. Right.
Yeah.
And we've seen this case of voter fraud in the past. We don't see this as often currently, which is what becomes very mm-hmm. interesting. You know, I mean, it seems as though people don't want to vote once, let alone vote multiple times, right? So the question becomes, you know, like, is there a place where you can simply, you know, register? But people should be able to do this regardless. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, with this, you know, if they have a social security number,
mm-hmm.
right, that they can list, right, like on a provisional ballot,
mm-hmm.
and then just submit it at a DMV or a post office,
mm-hmm.
right? That usually would be all it would take to, you know, to,
That's
I
fair.
Mean, to run a database with it.
Well, and that's
right?
the other thing, too. Nowadays, there are fingerprints. Like, it's not
Certainly.
That hard to, like, you know, you fingerprint the person. You have to, if you're going to vote in that way, right,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to do a provisional ballot or whatever, then you have to vote
sure.
with the fingerprint, like if you don't have ID. And that way you can
exactly.
check the database or whatever.
And not only that, but with the fingerprint, you would want to have ink that would last for, like, 7 days.
Yeah, there you go.
No, but, I mean,
yeah.
you have lots of invisible ink that would still last seven days. So,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
you could determine if they, you know,
right.
if they had already voted.
Right.
Right. It's not that hard. I mean,
yeah.
you know, look... You know, you go to places like Disneyland and they put a little stamp on your hand. You know, it's like, oh my God. Yeah, but it can tell if you've already been in or not.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you know, so you're not a criminal, right? If Disneyland can do it, I should sure as hell hope that the United States government could.
I don't know about that. I mean,
okay,
Disneyland is amazingly run.
I know. I mean, okay, it's a high bar.
Yeah, and
it's a very
really
high bar.
High bar.
Right.
And you know, we may reach the stage where Disney dollars are worth more than U.S. dollars.
Dude, don't get me started. It's,
yeah.
it's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
just a matter of time.
Listen, Goofy looks really, really good on the 10.
Really?
Oh, yeah,
yeah I
does.
Bet he does. Yeah, I know. I know. He's chilling. But so, yeah, so as a result, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways in which you can change structural
mm-hmm.
rules that encourage participation on a number of facets, right?
Mm-hmm.
A number of things that I would say is that, first off, you got to get rid of felon disenfranchisement laws. You got to get, I mean, that for people who are, you know, on probation or parole in particular, right, those are people who should still be allowed to, you know, to vote, right?
If you believe they've paid their debt to society, right?
Sure,
I mean, by definition.
But here's a question, though. Like, if you, because I would argue that even if you, most people haven't paid their debt to society, right?
No, I would agree. I think in general, I mean, I think the whole logic of prisons needs to clearly be rethought, like much more fundamentally. Like, what's the point of a prison?
But even so, like, why take away somebody's right to vote? I mean, if we want a democratic society, right, mm-hmm. you know, like, why take away someone's right to vote? I understand that you're being punished, right? You're being punished. Hi, you're going to prison. That sucks, mm-hmm. right? Like, prison sucks. Don't let anybody tell you differently. Prison sucks. Mm-hmm. Okay. In case you hadn't heard, and it's not just Oz. It's like, you know, whole, you know, it's all the other movies you can watch. But I've visited any number of prisons. And
but it's a great place to be bi-curious, right? I mean, I did watch Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
Apparently, you can really work out a lot of...
Yeah, and you know, it's beautiful because, of course, in prison, everything is consensual.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's all about
looks,
consent.
And everybody looks TV good.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, that's also the story of the L word. I was like, okay, the L word, I was like, man, those are some really attractive lesbians. Not so much in the real world. But here's the deal, right? If you want to punish someone, you are punishing them by sending them to prison, right? Why take away their vote, right? What good does it do to take away someone's vote other than to say that, you know, that you cannot participate, right? And to continue to take away their vote through parole, through probation, in which case they didn't serve a prison sentence, right? Or even, you know, in Florida and a number of other southern states where you're disenfranchised for life,
mm-hmm.
right? What does this say other than you can't participate? But, you know, if you want someone to become, care about their society, to have a sense of ownership in their society, the number one thing you can ask them to do is vote.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I'm a big believer in voting. I was born to vote, right? If
mm-hmm.
somebody took away my right to vote, I would be so sad, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would be verklempt. You know, you would see me just, you know, like, crying tears forever. Because I care about this society. I mean, I don't like losing. You know, that sucks. But I think that, you know, that is a punishment that does not necessarily fit the crime.
Well,
and
it doesn't fit the objective.
Exactly.
I think that's always much more important is, like, what outcome do you want?
And do you want someone who doesn't care about your society and doesn't follow the news and doesn't, you know, follow the issues that are going on in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, apparently that's what we're doing because over 6 million people currently right now are disenfranchised under felon disenfranchisement laws,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's important. And they're disproportionately persons of color. They're disproportionately men of color. And I think that is something, it sends the wrong message. It says that, you know, you shouldn't participate,
mm-hmm.
right? And you know, if you want a democracy, if you want a real democracy and not whatever it is we have right now, right, then one of the things you have to have is, you know, is people participating,
mm-hmm.
right? This is a government of the people, for the people, by the people.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing is, you know, that there are a lot of people who are effectively being isolated and shut out of the system through government policy, and that needs to change.
Well, but again, this requires clarity on the part of voters.
Certainly.
Like the existing voters, right? I mean,
certainly.
You know, I mean, and I think that's the thing. It's, you know, I always think that the danger is that when you start talking about, like, it's important, obviously, to talk about minority groups, but when
sure.
you start
sure,
talking
sure, sure.
about minority groups, what ends mm-hmm. up happening is that then the narrative is split,
sure.
and then a lot of people tune out. And I think that there's so much progress to be made first by focusing on the stuff that we all have in common, like
yeah.
campaign finance. Like,
certainly.
Let's fix that, which is an issue for you wherever you are on the political spectrum.
Sure. But also, let's fix this democracy that we all share,
mm-hmm.
right? And this isn't, you know, this doesn't have to do necessarily with a minority issue or with, you know, majority issue or this or that. This is that what kind of democracy do you want?
Right.
Right. And part of that is campaign finance reform. Get the money out of politics.
Right.
But part of that also is how do we create a democracy or how do we, you know, make changes and amend our democracy so that we have full participation or the closest to full participation that we can get,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, you know, because otherwise it undermines the legitimacy of the institutions
100%.
That we have in place, right?
But I think then separately to return to cognitive psychology.
Of course.
Like, how do you maintain sufficient attentional focus on a platform or on a plan or on a particular proposal that, you know, momentum builds and that actual change is enacted. Because the problem is, right, you know, John McCain, you know, goes out there because, I mean, he was the most visible person for campaign finance reform,
certainly,
right?
Certainly.
He goes out there, he talks about campaign finance reform. Most people are like, I get that this is kind of an issue, but I don't really get why this is an issue, right?
Certainly.
So then he goes and he doesn't have a mandate from the people to go and fix this. You know, they pass BCRA, right? Mm-hmm. Great, which like has some things. And then, you know, the Supreme Court has a bunch of Supreme Court cases. Mm-hmm. And then we're like, you know, some people, like people who are, you know, lawyers and deeply interested in all of this sort of stuff are like, this is the end of the world. Like, this is terrible. This is really bad. Mm-hmm. But the general public is like, I don't get it. Like, why is I don't get why this is like such a bad thing. And, you know, the challenge is, I think that the major challenge that we're facing mm-hmm. is how do you get the voter base to have clarity, such blinding clarity of what needs to be done that they not only vote for it, mm-hmm. but then that they are watching it and making sure that Congress is actually following through on it for until that legislation is passed, that they're not going to put up with the Supreme Court, you know, undermining this legislation. Like, it's that clarity. Like, I think that's the problem that we need to figure out. And that's what I'm talking about, because I 100% agree. Like, you know, we want to make sure that this is not just, I mean, most of American history is an attempt to live up to our original founding principle that all men are created equal. And like, we should fill up, you know, we should meet that. Yeah. But there's a sequence of events to achieving that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how is it that we get, because how do we get something done? Like, how do we reach that place of actually having a majority of America committed to fixing something and sticking with it?
Well, I mean, part of it is that you have to be able to petition, you know, your representatives and stuff like that. And I mean, and I say that, you know, with the idea that, look, right now, for instance, we have some legislation in the Senate, at least, that is trying to overturn Citizens United, right? And you know, Harry Reid mm-hmm. Put it to a vote for, you know, so there will be eventually a vote on whether to overturn Citizens United in the Senate. However, you know, whether or not the House actually goes along with it is a different story. And your viewers need to remember that both the House and the Senate have to agree on something before anything can be signed into law by the President of the United States. Now, you know, for what it's worth, in terms of just their willingness to debate, right, we have 78 senators, right, who supported, you know, a debate to overturn Citizens United. Now, that does not mean that they'll actually vote to overturn Citizens United, but they're willing to debate, and that's crucial.
Mm-hmm.
You need to petition your members of Congress, local, state, and national levels in terms of your representatives to say, this is what I want, right? We need to build a platform, right, mm-hmm. that can be made available online that says, you know, like, I mean, this needs to be a manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
Right? A democratic manifesto that says we want full participation and we want to eliminate laws that get rid of it. We want full participation and we feel, you know, and we want the end of manipulation through money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That there are certain key aspects of a democratic society that are fundamentally flawed or fundamentally lost
mm-hmm.
in current American politics to date.
Mm-hmm.
Right? One thing I would also add is that at least in terms of advertising right now, right, as it is, you know, technically money is protected as speech, right? We need to have regulations even in terms of what ads can be run
mm-hmm.
and whether, you know, and hopefully nonpartisan regulation of what ads can be run according to whether or not they are lying.
I'm with you 100% on all of this.
Okay.
But
yeah.
How do we get to clarity? Because if you listen, I agree, right? Mm-hmm. We need a manifesto and we need all that sort of stuff. If you have a manifesto mm-hmm. that has both campaign finance reform and the fact that felons should be able to vote, well, I got some news for you.
Yeah.
You're going to lose consensus on campaign finance because you're saying felons should be able to vote. There's a whole section of the country that is not going to get behind that. Whether it's a fulfillment, you know, like that's a separate issue.
Sure.
And you've now put these two things in one basket together.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think that you necessarily have to say felon disenfranchisement as much as you want to say, I want full participation. I believe in democracy. Democracy means that people participate, right? That this is a government of the people, for the people, by the people. And as such, right, I want to eliminate barriers to participation, right? I mean, and that would not just include felon disenfranchisement laws. It would also include, you know, like having an election week. Right. It would also, I mean, like, look, there are all sorts of laws on the books. Like, for instance, Utah requires you to shut the bars on election day. Right. Now, quite frankly, I think they would shut the bars regardless.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, let's be very clear here.
Yeah.
But there are all sorts of structural laws. Right. Yeah. I mean, New York, for instance, the state of New York has the longest day of election voting. Right. They have 15 hours. Right. Now, incidentally enough, they also have the highest turnout. Right. They have, you know, 15 hours from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. People can vote. And in California, I think it's 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. So we have a 12-hour day.
Yeah.
But what we've seen is that even the length of poll hours, right, increases or can increase or decrease the amount, the number of people who show up. There needs to be, you know, included in this kind of a structural understanding of how the rules can manipulate the system and decrease turnout.
So where's that manifesto, Professor Tyson?
I've been working on it since I was about three.
Yeah, but when are you going to be done?
Oh, you
do
want
we need, I, do we need to Kickstarter
okay.
it?
Okay, if yeah, you need to Kickstarter it. Somebody's got to pay me.
Yeah.
Lord, I'm digging into savings. But yeah, so we could you know, if you like, I mean, I'll write the manifesto if you provide me some internet space to put it up.
Well, the internet space is free.
Okay, really?
But you know, we'll bring you on here and we'll talk about it.
Okay, cool.
And we'll go through it point by point.
Okay.
But I mean, I think that's the thing is, yeah, we need it strikes me that the issue with all of this is that the people are disengaged and they need clarity.
Yes.
Right? And clarity, because clarity leads to action.
And it's but I mean, I think, and this is the one thing that I want to impress upon you, is the idea that you also need integrity. And what I mean by this is that I would, you know, to win a few votes, I'm not willing to forego felon disenfranchisement, right? Like,
no, and, I understand.
And what I mean is that, you know, like, yes, you need money out of politics. I firmly believe that. But I also think that there are other reasons why, you know, that if you want a manifesto, it, you know, it's going to include all, you know, parts that people don't like, but that are ideologically sound.
Right. No, I understand. But you, and that's the thing. And there's always been the room in this country for pieces of writing that are so clear that, you know, common sense, the Declaration of Independence does this, that, you know, are so clear that you can progress people to a place where they understand why these things are necessary and essential, right? And that it, that preempts their, that preempts, you know, their objections, right? And says, I know that you're worried about, you know, essentially felons voting out of existence, you know, all criminal laws, which is, you know, the fear. But, I mean, I just think, you know, that's, you know, whether it's a piecemeal thing, right, where we say, let's fix campaign finance and then we'll get on to the other issues, right? Or whether it's a holistic thing and then, you know, you're beat by beat by beat by beat going to go through those, that's fine.
Okay.
Right? But, you know, obviously what's going to happen is, you know, Fox News, as an example, is not going to talk about any of the campaign finance reform stuff. They're going to talk about death panels.
Oh, certainly. I mean, you know, their job seems, I mean, that's the problem with news right now, is that it's like a for-profit entity where, like, their job is to basically stoke the fears wherever they can.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing. It's the, I don't know that it's the for-profit nature of it. I think it's an understanding of how you achieve profit, right? Well, which is, I mean, it's not that people don't, I mean, like, people want to be inspired. They want to understand these things. I mean, people are, you know, they seek out TED Talks. Like, people want that.
Oh, certainly.
But
certainly.
It's low-hanging fruit. It's easy for them. It's all that sort of stuff. Fear is an easy emotion to get to. It's the other emotions that require work and thought.
I just wish that more people watched PBS NewsHour. It's my favorite hour of the day.
Yeah, but let's be also honest. A lot of the stuff that you watch is boring. Like, C-SPAN is boring. Like, occasionally there are really, really funny things. And to be clear, the reason why I'm saying it's boring, it's not inherently boring.
Okay.
It's just that the buy-in for finding that stuff interesting is so much knowledge and context that people don't have.
But I also think, and I want to add to this really quick, is simply the fact that if you want money out of politics, I think you need to get money out of news. I really do.
Well, but there's, you know, there's no, I mean, that's the thing, you know.
Because there's the conflicts of interest and, you know, kind of worry about integrity.
But
I honestly believe that.
Yeah, anyway, that's a separate, like, we didn't get to district. Yeah.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.